Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Las Musas podcast. My name is Terry Catasus Jennings, and I'm the author of The Little House of Hope. Today, I'm joined by Andrea Beatriz Arango, Emma Otegi, and Annika Fajardo. And today, on this episode of Debut Diaries, the Back to School edition, we'll be talking, of course, about going back to school. Andrea, can you start us off by introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about your book?
Yeah. Hi, Terry. My book is Ibelis Explains It All. It actually comes out in a month, in September 13th. So I'm very excited because it is coming back. It's coming out as a lot of students are going back to school. It is a middle grade novel in verse about Ibelis, who is navigating some mental health challenges while figuring out friendship, family, school, and all those sort of parts of her daily life.
Okay, Annika.
Hi, Terry, and hello, everyone else. I'm excited to be here. My book also comes out September 13th. It is my second middle grade novel. It is called What If... It is my second middle grade novel, and it is called Meet Me Halfway, and it is about new classmates Maddie Gomez and Mercedes Miller, who meet at the beginning of school and realize that they have the same Colombian dad. And the two team up in a parent trap inspired adventure to try to find him and meet him for the first time.
Well, so that is a really good back to school book. Emma, how about you? You want to share your books?
Sure. I'm Emma Otegi, and I'm the author of Sofia Acosta Makes a Scene, which is a middle grade novel about housing, immigration, and classical ballet. And my newest book is Reina Ramos Works It Out, which will be out in September. It is the first book in an I Can Read series about Reina, who is a little girl in New York, and she has a lot of energy. She sometimes causes a little bit of chaos with her high energy antics, but she's a loyal friend and she's always trying to find a way to set things right. So that's Reina Ramos coming out in September.
Okay. And my books, my latest book is, I've been very lucky this year. I've had two books come out. And in June, my picture book, The Little House of Hope, came out. It's about a Cuban American family that rents an old tattered house and shines it up and cleans it up and makes it a home. But when they find other immigrants who need a place to stay, they open up their home so that these newcomers can get a foot in their new country. And it's illustrated by Raul Colon. And in February, my biography in verse of Pauli Murray, The Life of a Pioneering Feminist and Civil Rights Activist, came out. And it's about a queer Black lawyer in the 1940s who came up with the idea that eventually won Brown versus Board of Education. And she desegregated schools, but of course she was a woman, she presented as a woman, and she was not given any credit. And she was also responsible for including women's rights to equal pay in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And I collaborated with her niece, Rosita Stevens Halsey, on that book. So let's get started talking about about back to school. What is your favorite back to school part of back to school, Andrea? And what do you think is the worst part?
You know, I'm actually feeling a little bit lost with back to school this year because for the past 10 years, I've been a teacher in the public schools, and this is the first year that I'm not. So usually my favorite part of back to school as a teacher was just getting to meet all of my new students that I would be working with for the year. And the worst part was the lack of knowing. Sometimes schools can be a little disorganized and I might not know like my schedule or how certain things are gonna run. This year, it's a little bit different, and I think my favorite and worst are all together, and it's my book coming out because I'm so nervous for my debut. But yeah, it's a little bit different this year.
So, Andrea, what did you, I mean, like, is it really, really different not having to, you know, plan everything and get going?
Yeah, it's really weird seeing like all my friends like getting their classrooms ready, and I'm like, ah, what did I do? You know, trying out this author thing. We'll see how it works. But no, I'll still be volunteering and stuff like that, still involved with the kids. But yeah, it's very different to not be in a teacher role this year.
Amazing. Annika, how about you? What was your favorite part of back to school and your worst?
Well, I can totally relate to Andrea because I was a teacher and then I worked in academia for a really long time. And so I'm about 5 years out from not being like officially back to school, but I have a teenager. So our lives still revolve around the back to school schedule. And I love the way back to school is like an excuse for new beginnings. And it's like having spring in the fall. And I'm excited this year when my daughter goes back to high school. I'm hoping that's going to be motivation to get back into a regular writing routine. And once my book comes out, I feel like I'm going to get back into the fun part of being a writer, which is the actual writing part. I live in Minneapolis. And so the worst part about back to school for, I think, everyone in this area is that it means that winter is coming. Like, that's all I can think about. Oh my goodness, it's going to get cold again. So that's definitely the worst part about this time of year.
Wow. I cannot imagine Annika living in Minneapolis. I do not do well with the cold at all. I also feel that way, but it's going to be a lot less cold here in a much shorter winter. So yeah, I mean, for me, I think that like both of you shared, I'm similar to both of you in that I was a teacher and then I went to graduate school. And so I was very much like in the academic world for a long time, but now have been writing full time for a while. So I sort of feel like I'm sort of in it, but sort of not in it. So I think for me, the best part of back to school when I was a kid and now is that feeling of limitless possibility and excitement and something new. Andrea, I have a book coming out. So you said that your book it's September 13th, is that correct?
Yes.
Right? I have a book out on September 20th, so the week after. So we should definitely talk about like September book launches.
And mine is September 13th too.
Oh, too. Oh my gosh.
Andrea and I are sisters, book sisters.
Everybody has a September book launch. So yeah, I think that feeling of there's something special about having a book come out in September also, because you're like starting the new school year with a new book. So that is something that I'm very excited about. But when I look back at when I was a kid and, you know, thinking about what was the worst part of back to school for me when I was growing up. And I think that what comes up for me is I felt like there was such a divide in my young life between the life I lived in the summers with my family, particularly with my extended family, and the life I had in the classroom come September. My father's family lived in Puerto Rico, so I would go every summer. We would be at my grandmother's house. I spent a lot of time with all of my cousins there. It was a huge part of my identity and my relationship with my family. And then I would get back to school in September, and in the community that I was in, people had gone to summer camp and they'd gone on family vacations, and nobody had been in Puerto Rico for the summer. That was just like, was not part of what their experience was. And it was, I never really learned how to bridge that divide and how to talk about my experiences. And that was always very difficult for me because I was somebody who really wanted to feel seen and heard and understood, but I just didn't really know how to bring up something that felt so different. And so I think the beginning of school was also a time when I learned to kind of like pull it all inside and not talk about it too much, and just kind of hold those experiences very close to my heart, which didn't really give me a lot of opportunities to forge connections with my classmates. And that was the most challenging part for me. And I imagine for a lot of young people today is a continuing challenge.
Emma, you've reminded me of very much of the way I was as a child. I did not go back to Cuba, of course you can't, but we were very poor. I mean, I was very poor coming up. And yes, everybody around my neighborhood went to summer camp. They all went to the pool. Everybody had memberships at the pool. Everybody was doing this and that and the other. And the little Cuban kid didn't get to do any of that. But on the other hand, to me, going back to school was, wow, finally being able to have the community, because I was all by myself here. I didn't have that extended family. Yeah, we did go visit my family. We were in Richmond, Virginia. So very alone as far as family was concerned. So we did go see them for a couple of weeks, but it was like coming back to school to me was coming back to my friends. And then there was one thing that always reminds me of back to school. This is being a child. There was a store in Havana that was called Ultra. And then that's where we went to buy my school supplies. And I can remember the smell of the school supplies at Ultra. It's one of those things that, you know, it's always in my mind. And I have put in several of my books that it's just, you know, Prismacolor pencils, a brand new box of Prismacolor pencils. That's what back to school meant to me. So yeah, it's a very interesting time. It is a time of new beginnings. And to me, I don't think there was a worse time for school. I always loved school. That was my very, you know, there was no worse for me on there. So now speaking back to putting our own information in our books, how does school figure in your book, Andrea?
So it's interesting, Emma, what you were saying about going to Puerto Rico for the summers, because that's what Ibeliz does in my book. That's all her family lives. Yeah. But, you know, school is actually not a great place for Ibeliz in my book, just because she is going through so many things. And unfortunately, sometimes, you know, the spaces that we inhabit don't make it easy for us to ask for help or find the resources that we need. And so in her case, you know, she's in school and there are teachers and guidance counselors and the principal and all of these adults who, you know, could be helping, but they just don't know what's going on. And she doesn't know how to communicate what's going on. You know, similarly to what you were saying, Emma, there's like a lot of her peers don't understand, you know, she has like issues with them. And so, yeah, school isn't a super happy place in my book. You know, it wasn't a super happy place for me either. Like I got teased a lot when I was younger. And so I think, you know, school has so much potential. That's part of what I love about it. And part of what I loved about being a teacher was, you know, the adults who work at school really shape that environment and really shape how that place can be. And so I hope that if adults read my book, you know, with their kids or with their students, that they'll keep those sort of things in mind and watch for like how they can be watching for the Ibelises in their life, who might not feel ready to speak up. But, you know, if you listen to a child, you can find out a lot. And so that's part of what I'm hoping to do with my book, is just gentle reminder to people who work in education, you know, that we kind of have to put in the effort sometimes, because kids can't or won't be able to.
I wish I'd had you as a teacher, Andrea.
Thank you. That's very sweet.
Annika, how about you?
Well, my first book, What If a Fish, takes place during the summer, and little Eddie, the main character, goes to Colombia, but this is a new adventure for him to do that. And I was kind of scared to write about school. He's very nervous about starting middle school in the fall. And I was very nervous about writing about the school as a setting, but my new book, Meet Me Halfway, does start in the very first weeks of school for seventh grade for Maddie and Mercedes. And Maddie has just moved to California from Minnesota, because her mom just got remarried. And she ends up starting school a couple weeks late because of the change in state. So her mom and her stepdad don't realize that school starts before Labor Day in California. And their wedding is actually over Labor Day weekend. And so she's really upset to start school late. She's not only the new kid, she's also like new. Like everyone else has kind of gotten going in the school year. But I really wanted to set it up so that Maddie had extra issues, and so we could really raise the stakes for her. And especially when she first meets Mercedes and they look alike, and Maddie has no idea how or why they look alike. And whereas Mercedes knows exactly who Maddie is the moment that she meets her. And so it was fun for me to kind of figure out, like, here's seventh grade. It's brand new for Maddie. Schools in California are so different from schools in Minnesota. And so she's kind of navigating not just new kids, but kind of the new experience of being in a warm climate where things are completely different. And she has this new family to figure out. And Mercedes is the popular kid and has lots of friends. And, you know, it's kind of that end of the school experience. And so they're both having a really different experience in school.
Well, now I'm going to go ahead and jump in as far as whether school figures in my books. And in The Little House of Hope, of course, these new kids. And Andrea, what you said was very germane to everything, because we do have to watch out for these kids. My kids are immigrants and they're brand new in their school. So they have to, you know, we do want teachers to watch out for everybody and help them. In the Polly Murray book that just came out, she was in a family of educators. Her grandfather was a teacher, her aunt, her father, her other aunt, all of them were teachers. And so she eventually actually became a teacher. So schools do figure out very prominently, but it's in the past. School you can say has to figure out in just about every book that we write. Emma, would you like to chime in?
Yeah, I'm so glad that everybody's been talking about their middle grade stories and the challenge that, you know, Andrea and Annika, you were both saying that the experience of starting a new school year, particularly for middle grade readers who I think are themselves going through these transitions. So in Sofia Acosta Makes a Scene, Sofia is just starting fifth grade at the beginning of the book. So she is in the same class as Trisha, her best friend, who she's been in the same class with since she was in kindergarten. And she is auditioning for the Nutcracker because her parents are big ballet people. So it's like back to school. She thinks everything is going to be the same as always. She's going to do the Nutcracker. Her and Trisha are going to be like best friends. And then what new school year thing is happening at her school? Well, her teacher, Mr. Fallon, has recently become a United States citizen. And because there's commonly an immigration unit taught in New York in that grade, somebody has the brilliant idea that they can do a special party for Mr. Fallon and pair it with the immigration unit. And it's going to be all of this talk about immigration history. And there's going to be a big party at the school in honor of Sophia's teacher. And Sophia starts working on that party and learning more about immigration history. And what does she discover? Most of the immigration history that's taught in schools, in elementary school, is the history of European immigration. And so that leads Sophia to start questioning her own family's immigration history and the immigration history, not only of her family as individuals, but of Latin people more broadly and of different people of different Latin backgrounds. And so she's really starting to question a lot about immigration. And that actually starts to challenge her relationship with her best friend, Trisha. And the one amazing thing that school gives her, right? I mean, in many ways, school is challenging her. It's bringing to a head all of these issues of the ways in which we honor and talk more about the history of European immigration, and we don't honor the immigration experiences of other groups. But what does school give her that's a great thing? It's time to journal. So every single day when she gets to school, her teacher, Mr. Fallon, puts a do now on the board, and it's a writing prompt. And you can write about the writing prompt, or you can write about something else. And Sophia starts writing in her notebook about what she cares about her family, about what makes her family special. And through that process of writing every day, she really starts to understand where she fits in much better, the types of friendships she wants to have, as opposed to the types of friendships she feels she has to have because she's been best friends with Trisha since kindergarten. And it's a really transformative experience for me. And that part is very autobiographical. I had a teacher in the fifth grade who had us do a lot of free writing, who really made our notebooks those kind of sacred spaces for us that were really private and personal. And that was transformative for me, and it's transformative for Sophia in my book.
Nice. You know, I need to get all of your books. They all sound so wonderful. Yeah, and one of the things that I had thought about was, and maybe we can just jump in real quick, if there was any teacher like Mr. Fallon, your Mr. Fallon, Emma, Andrea, did you have any teacher who was your, you know, your inspiration?
Yeah. Her name is Amara Garcia, and she was my high school English. So, you know, in Puerto Rico, we have our Spanish language arts class, but we also have an English class because, you know, U.S. territory. So she was my English teacher in high school. And I was lucky to have her for 2 years. And I remember she was the first teacher who ever gave me a C on an essay. And my world was falling apart because I prided myself on being like a really good writer, right, as a kid. But, you know, she was the first teacher who actually pushed me, who was like, no, you can do better. And she was very honest with me. She's like, I mean, this C is not the same as maybe someone else's C, but it's a C for you because I want to see, you know, your A level work or whatever. And, you know, she pushed me really hard to better my writing, but she was also sort of a mentor and would always listen to me, you know, whatever I was going through at the time, you know, relationships, whatever, like I could talk to her about it. And you know, we're friends on Facebook. We still talk occasionally. So, I mean, yeah, we all have those teachers, and she's definitely mine. Like I still think about her a lot.
Yep. Sandra Clements was my ninth grade English teacher, and we're still friends on Facebook. And she's, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to have that relationship. Annika, how about you?
Like Emma, mine was also my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Thompson, who was, I think, not that far from retirement when I had her in the 80s. And so she was my language arts teacher and so encouraging of writing. We did a ton of free writing. I remember that one of my favorite stories from her was that she had grown up in outstate Minnesota. And she went to a one-room schoolhouse. So that must have been so long ago. And when she was little, like in the younger grades in the one-room schoolhouse, she would hear about how the older kids got to study frozen poetry. And she couldn't wait until she was old enough to study frozen poetry, only to discover when she got older that they were studying prose and poetry. And so I loved that story that just kind of showed, like, even though she was this amazing teacher who was so smart, like when she was little, she also was confused about things. And she really encouraged my writing and gave me so much really great feedback, telling me that I could be a writer. I won a poetry contest that year when I was in her class that she forwarded my poem in order to be entered in it. And we kept in touch when I graduated from high school. She gave me a book of poetry and inscribed it and said, I just know you're going to be a writer someday. And I just really, you know, that kind of encouragement is so impactful for a kid. My family did not encourage me to be a writer. They wanted me to do something that was an actual job, you know. But, you know, my family were nurses. My grandmother wanted me to be a teacher so badly. And nobody thought being a writer was an actual job. And so she was the person who really encouraged me to follow my dreams. Took me a long time to get there, but I did it finally. So those teachers are so important.
Yeah. And, you know, I think to what you said about your family not encouraging you, I don't think as an immigrant, it would have been, it's not the smartest thing in the world to be a writer, because you need to have a steady job. You need to have a job that puts food on the table. So, you know, my parents never encouraged me to be a writer. It just wasn't going to be. What about, let's talk about how books prepare kids for back to school. Andrea, you want to start us off?
Yeah. So I know like what you were saying, Terry, where like everyone else went to summer camp.
Emma? Yeah. You know, Andrea, you brought up something that intersects in a really interesting way with reading. So if you read Sofia Costa Makes a Scene, you'll find out that I'm a little bit of a housing nerd, I'll say, for lack of a better word. And so we live in this deeply segregated world, right? Like the United States is a place in which we are deeply segregated in our homes, in the places that we live. And books, in some cases, like the way you described it, Andrea, it was almost like the books for you were compensating for something, right? Like it was like compensating for what you didn't get to see. And then, because I'm assuming that when you were a kid and you were going to this to get these books, I'm assuming that the kids in the books were not kids who were like living in Puerto Rico and spending summer at their grandparents'.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about this like this beautiful experience, but really, yeah, books now are far more diverse than anything I had available to me as a kid.
And I think that this is absolutely right about all of us, is that none of us, right? I mean, we don't need to say this anymore because we all know it. None of us grew up seeing ourselves represented in books. No, none of us grew up seeing anybody represented in books, because the experience that was represented was very narrow. We were seeing represented a very white, a very upper middle class, a very suburban experience that was very narrow. That didn't mean that those books didn't provide you with joy, that they didn't build your literacy skills, that they didn't build your empathy skills. It just means that there's something that wasn't represented. And so I think about where we are now, where the housing piece hasn't changed. And I really hope that it's going to change. Like, I really hope everybody's going to go read Sofia Costa Makes a Scene and become a housing advocate. But I'm also not holding my breath for that, because that's something I can't control, right? But the books are changing, right? I do think that we have better representation in books. We're having more conversations like this in Las Musas. And that's true of every group that was not previously represented in books. There's tons that needs to be done. There are tons of groups that we're still not seeing in books. And I think things are more so than they were a generation ago. And so I guess when I get to the question of how do books better prepare kids for school or for life or for life in the world, in this society that we live in, I think about this idea that you only get one life, right? Like each of us only get to live one life. We only get to experience the world in the specifics of where we live. And we know that where we live is like so deeply siloed. And yet books are like they're like your shot at seeing the world outside of your own experience. They give you this way of experiencing and seeing and getting into the heads of people who have had different experiences than you. And I think that's really valuable. And I think it's especially valuable in the year 2022, when so many more books are available and more, I hope, are coming, that I think it's just a really special opportunity for kids who are readers in this moment to really truly read the world, because we're not housing the world, but maybe they can read the world. Maybe that's pie in the sky, but that's what I think.
No, it's not pie in the sky, and it is very necessary. And we still, even though, like you said, the amount of diversity in books has increased, you know, tremendously. Back in, like, I want to say it was 1995, they didn't even keep statistics on how many books were about African Americans or by and about Latinx. they weren't. There were no statistics kept. So it was that little. And still, as far as Latin books, we are still not anywhere near the percentage. We're probably about a third of what we could be. We're not anywhere near close. But I do think I want to go to something, the fact that these kids, that the books do help the kids, especially now that we have some diversity. They show kids how other kids may have navigated that first day of school. And I'm thinking about Isabel and her Colores go to school, Alexandria, and Santiago and his Dinosaurios. That's going to be, I don't think that's quite out yet, by Mariana Rivera, but it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And it's just how other kids have negotiated the language barrier without words. Andrea Wang has a brand new book coming out, and it's called Luli and the Language of Qi, in a place where a Chinese child comes to school and does not have, is unable, goes to preschool and is unable to talk. And she starts talking about tea. So, you know, books do help. And then of course, was it Andrea, was it Annika that talked about the summer, that reading, making sure that the kids are reading in the summer. The summer is the most important time, I think, for reading. Number one, it keeps the kids going, but also they have the opportunity, the reluctant readers may have the opportunity to read something that's not prescribed, something that's fun, and then maybe find that book that will spark their interest and to let them become lifelong readers. I think the summer is a wonderful time to have.
That's why I'm so pro libraries too, because absolutely, libraries are the ones making sure these kids can read for free over the summer. And
absolutely. Now that's another thing that's different. I did not have a library in my school growing up. How about you guys? How about Columbia? How about Annika? How about you? Did you have a library in your school?
I grew up in Minnesota, and
oh, you
we
did.
Have
okay.
Amazing schools. Amazing.
Okay.
Especially okay. Back then, we had every school had a librarian. And
yeah.
Really great access to books.
Yeah, but
it's not as good as it used to be now. But
yeah.
Okay, so. I also went to, I was going to say that I think that we really, the library issue, or the disappearing librarians, is a really, I think it really is a crisis. Annika, like you, I went to a school that did have a school library. And I went back recently, and there still is a library there, but they changed the librarian's roles, and so that there's like a district librarian who's wonderful, but it's different from having a full-time librarian that's like in every library, in every school library all the time, and that makes me sad. And you know, Terry, I wanted to bring up, you know, you talked about like the importance of maintaining literacy over the summer through reading. I don't know if any of you read Game Changer. It's Donalyn Miller and Colby Sharp, but they talk in that book about learning loss in the summer and different programs that have been done. And they talk about a study. I don't know which study this was yet. I would have to pull down the book and go look at it. But they talk about a study that actually looked at kids who went to summer school compared to basically a control group. I mean, it was not like a vaccine trial, but you know, basically they created a control group, these researchers, of kids who instead were just given a handful of books of their choice. They got to go somewhere and choose from brand new books, not like anybody's discards, but brand new, just published, new and exciting books, and pick books for themselves. And they found that just having access to books of their own choosing was the most effective for kids learning over the summer. I thought that was like, everybody in the book publishing world needs to know this fact.
Absolutely. And it's not surprising once you say it, right? I have a kid who has a great deal of trouble reading. He's 38 now, but you know, he would not read until he found Michael Crichton. And then it was like, oh yeah, okay, I can read. And it's just like, you got to find that one book that will spark your interest, and then the benefits are, you know, forever. I think this goes without saying, but why are schools such an important home for our books? Andrea, you want to take that one, be the first one on that one?
Yeah, I think just like how we've mentioned, just the accessibility factor. If my book is in a classroom library or in a school library, then kids have access to it for free. and, you know, that alone is just such a big, big, important. I mean, books are expensive. And, you know, our books come out in hardcover first. So it's like, even though kids' books are cheaper than adult books, you know, that's still like $16 to $18. Which is why I've been such like, I let my publisher know. I was like, I really want my book in schools and in libraries. That's like a big priority for me, because yeah, kids should have access to free books. that's it, period.
Annika, how about you?
When I was a fifth grade teacher, I did every day after recess, we had silent reading time where we would kind of have this like quiet 25 minutes. Kids, I had a classroom library. They were, you know, we used beat up books, but kids could bring their own books, but they usually used books from my classroom library. And it was just, you read, you can't do anything else. You just read. They would sit on the floor, they'd be underneath the desk, they could be anywhere they wanted in the classroom. And it was just a time where the most important thing was that you were reading. And I had one of the years I taught, I had kids who were reading, preschool, kindergarten level in fifth grade. And so it was really important for them just to spend some time, even with books. I had a lot of immigrant children who were migrants and just hadn't spent a lot of time holding books even. So kind of those very basic beginning literacy experiences that were happening every day and where everyone was doing it. And I also modeled as the teacher. I also read during that time, so I didn't use it to catch up on work or anything. And I think that that's really important. And I know that was 20 years ago. So I know that a lot of it's changed in schools, and that, you know, there's not a lot of wiggle room for that kind of unstructured time. And I think that any way that schools and teachers can nurture that kind of experience is so important, even if it's a very small part of the day, maybe that it would be now than it used to be. My character in What If a Fish is obsessed with encyclopedias, and he's found this secondhand cassette of encyclopedias. And so he goes around, he just reads encyclopedias front to back because he's fascinated by information, and he has a lot of anxiety. And so he feels like if he can learn the truth about things, it's going to kind of calm him down. And so he, you know, just having books around that are the right books, like we were saying, like Tara, you said, finding the right book, like it might not be a fiction book, it might be an encyclopedia for someone. And so just having schools where there's books available and where reading is valued.
Miss Emma.
Yeah, books need to be in public institutions. Andrea said it perfectly, right? Kids deserve to have free books. They deserve.
I feel like Emma, we just met, but I feel like we're supposed to be best friends.
Like... I was the entire time on the day. I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel like you wrote a book that's maybe about my life. I haven't read it yet, but it sounds similar in certain ways. So I'm really excited to read it. And also, I think we have very similar values. And I really believe this. I really believe that this is foundational for living in a democratic society. Kids need access to media, and they need that media to be provided to them by public institutions. I simply do not think it is the responsibility of parents to provide their kids with books. That's not to say that I don't think it's a great thing to do. If I turn my camera around, you would be looking at my apartment, which is filled with children's books, and I spend an alarming amount of money on books for my children. But I really believe that it's just, it's in a democracy, it is the responsibility of the people to provide access to education to children, and education means books in my world. And I think most of us can agree that a good education means books. And I also think it's very strange the way books get treated relative to other educational tools in schools. I always think, like, you would never have it be like, hey, parents, we want to buy computers for the computer lab. So we're going to send home a form and you have to send in like $16.99 in a little envelope. That wouldn't happen. It would be part of the school budget. And so I really believe that schools and libraries need to have access to new book funds every single school year, because books change so fast. I mean, it is it is amazing to me how quickly books can become dated, and just how appealing new books especially are to kids. So I think kids need books to be available to them in schools and libraries, i.e. public institutions. I think those books should be paid for by the public. I think they should be a line item. They should be a part of the school budget. And I think they should be new books that really... that really give kids an opportunity, the opportunity to read all of these newer, more diverse, more cutting edge books that are being published these days. I always say that I do a lot of school visits at all different types of schools. And I find that when I go to very wealthy schools, kids have like very individual reading preferences. They're like, I am interested in this one specific author. Have you met her? I like read every single thing she publishes. I've pre-ordered her. My parents have pre-ordered her next book for me. They're in some ways really being exposed more to the more diverse titles that are being published right now. And then when I go to poorer schools, I find that kids are like, my favorite book is Where the Red Fern Grows, or my favorite book is Dear Mr. Henshaw, because that's the only book they've ever read, because that's the only book the school owns. Right. And that's a huge problem. So books in public institutions, books paid for by the public, new books. That's my index card / platform. Those are the things I want for kids.
Okay, and I'm gonna add to that, because you know, we do want the new books, and we want the kids, you know, if they have heard something at home that doesn't make sense, and they can get a different perspective from a book. They can get something, they can get answers to their questions, to the things that they're questioning through a book. And so we absolutely have to provide the young minds a way to answer all the questions that they might have. And like you said, I agree that everybody should buy books for their kids, not their responsibility, but often the books that a family will buy will not be the books that the kids need. And it's so important for the kids to have all sorts of perspectives available to them. And they need books to escape to, and they need to, some kids need a book to provide them a different home, you know, an imaginary home, or see themselves as heroes in their own stories. And because there's no way that they're heroes in their own lives, and for them to find hope in other people's stories when they see someone facing a problem like their own, that they'll find hope for themselves in that story. So absolutely, we need those books, need to be there, they need to be free, they need to be easily available. What kind of material teacher materials do you guys provide for the teachers? And Andrea and Annika, since you guys were teachers, Emma, were you a teacher too? Did I miss that? Or
briefly,
yeah. So how did you use, or did you use teacher, you know, the materials that authors wrote or provided?
Yeah, so I don't know. You know, when you have a book coming out and it's your first time, there's a lot of things that you hear from a lot of different people. And so at some point, someone said to me that there would be materials created. I don't know if that's still happening. I guess we'll find out. I know as a teacher, if a book If I was stuck between, like, let's say three books that I wanted to teach in class, and one of them had educational materials, I picked that one. Like, if I liked them all equally, but one had part of my planning already done for me, that's the one I went with. Because teachers just don't have enough time for all the things they need to do. And so I do think that teacher materials are so helpful to go along with our books. That being said, if you can pay a teacher to help you make them, or, you know, I think that's the way to go, because teachers know what standards of learning they have to teach at any given grade level. And so they can kind of match that to what they're forced to teach anyways, so that no one can come in and say, but how does this fit into our curriculum? You know, you can go and say, well, actually, it hits this, this, and this. So yeah, I think it is helpful to go to actual teachers for help with that. I am hopeful that my book will have materials made for me by the school and library division of Random House. But if not, then, you know, we'll work on making those, because I do love books that have them.
I found out that my teacher materials in my latest book, the other two books did not have teacher materials, and I knew that was going to happen, so I provided for that. But I found out by looking on my portal at the Holiday House website. So that was how I found out. Nobody told me that they had done them, but it's always good. And I totally agree with you that paying a teacher has been very, very helpful. And I mean, it gives credibility to what you have. So it is. Annika, how about you?
I created some education materials for What If a Fish. I don't think that they have been used. They weren't done through the publisher, and they weren't advertised through the publisher. I think partly what happened to me is that my book came out in 2020, in the summer of 2020. And so it is a fall through the cracks kind of book, I think. And so I haven't spent a lot of time on Meet Me Halfway. It doesn't have education materials right now. I'm going to wait and see before I invest time and money into that. So we'll see. I did create discussion questions, and I have my first book was a memoir for adults, but it's sometimes used in high school. And so I think that the discussion questions that I used that are actually connected with the publisher, those have been used. And so I think that was worth my time in creating those materials.
Yeah, most of my books have teacher's guides that were made by their publishers. So they're just, the easiest way to find them is if you go to my website. I have a drop-down menu with all of my books. And then if you click on that individual book and you just scroll, there'll be a place that says download educator's guide, and you can download it. And in my experience, since I know that we have, Andrea, your first book is coming out, and you were saying, I don't know if there's going to be a teacher's guide. I bet there will be. I don't want to speak for all of publishing, because it's obviously a very large industry and every publisher does things a little differently. And even sometimes every imprint does things a little differently. But my experience is that the school and library team sometimes works on just a slightly later schedule than the publicity team. So that at the beginning, right before the book comes out, they're really getting focused on getting you interviews and getting the book into blogs and into influencers' hands. And that then a little bit later, the school and library team will come in and create some teacher materials, because we hope that that book will have a longer life in the classroom. So I think if you go to my website, most of my books do have teacher's guides at this point, but they weren't all necessarily out like the day the book came out.
Yeah, that's absolutely the truth. And you just don't have time. There's so much other stuff that you're doing that you don't have time. One thing that I do is when I have a teacher materials, I may do them in dribs and drabs, and then I send them out. I have a list of teachers and librarians that I have accumulated over the years. And I might say, hey, here's the newest teacher materials. I just came up with some STEM activities for the Definitely Dominguita books. Here they are. So I'm going to send that out in September. And the other place that I put them is in the teaching books website. And I don't know how many teachers use that, but I understand that they are well respected. So I think that it's worth doing. So just a general logic kind of question. When do you guys reach out to teachers for author visits?
I feel like I keep answering everything with I don't know. Okay. I mean, I haven't reached out specifically to teachers yet. I feel like I'm friends with a lot of teachers, and I have a lot of teachers in my circles, and so, but my book isn't out yet, and so it seems kind of weird to start. I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just playing it by ear. After my book comes out, well, you know, because it's weird too, because my publicist is like doing some things, but like not others, and so I'm not super clear on like the conversations that I need to be having versus the ones he's having, and so. I haven't done any yet, but I'm here to listen and learn from the three of you.
You know, one thing that I have found recently is that more if you go to a bookstore, they have relationships with schools, and they may say, okay, would you like to do, you know, they'll do the books for you. And would you like to do a visit? Now, it may not be a well-paid visit. It may not be paid at all. But
yeah, no, that's the issue I'm facing, where my publicist said, that's what we usually do. And then it's mm-hmm. unpaid, but they agree to buy a certain number of copies. But the problem is that they only like to work with indie bookstores, like Barnes and Noble here. But I only have one indie bookstore in my town. And like, you can't even order books online from them. You know, you have to call them on the phone. They don't have relationships with any school. And so that's where kind of the confusion is happening, because he's like, well, I don't know, because usually I just talk to the bookstore. And you know, in my case, I've taught at the three counties that are around me. So I almost feel like it would be easier for me to just approach those counties on my own, because I've taught there. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Annika, how about you?
Yeah, I've kind of patched together things. I'm in touch. My publicist was in touch with my indie, and they wanted to know if I was interested in connecting for school visits. So I'm hoping that this year that will start happening. I've had a lot more luck doing not school visits, but other kind of conferences and talks and that kind of thing. Most of the school visits that I've done actually have come through the Texas Book Festival. I was part of the Reading Rockstars program. And then I did some through that provided me with some connection with the Center for Fiction. And so I did some school visits in New York during the pandemic with school virtual school visits there. And so I actually I've only done one school visit locally, which is kind of strange. So it's kind of hard to figure out exactly how school visits have fit in so far. My book actually won the Minnesota Book Award last year, and so I was expecting that would generate some interest locally. So who knows, maybe this year will be the year of the school visit for me.
I feel like this year too should be, like, I know last year my school was still not allowing any visitors in person. So hopefully this year, I think more schools are kind of going back to anything goes, for better or for worse. But that should mean that it should be easier for school visits.
Right, Emma?
Yeah, so my first book came out over 5 years ago at this point. So I've been doing this both pre and now during and whatever comes next in regards to the pandemic. So the way I do things is the general rule is I wait for people to contact me. So that's teachers that I've maybe met at conferences, teachers who have found me on the internet, that's school librarians, that's public librarians, that's administrators who are looking to do either school visits or professional development events. I just hope that people will contact me. And in general, that works out. The one scenario in which I do reach out directly to educators myself is if I'm going somewhere anywhere, anyway. And again, this happened a lot more before the pandemic, but if I knew that I was going to visit family in Miami, for example, that's when I would reach out to teachers in that area and say, hey, I'm going to be there, you know, in your area. Can we make something work? But otherwise, I generally go where people invite me. And I wanted to say something for our audience, because this is Las Musas, which is about Hispanic Heritage Month, which starts really, really fast, especially if you're here in the Northeast where school doesn't start till after Labor Day. Hispanic Heritage Month sneaks up on you really, really fast. And I'm always very hesitant in how I talk about this because I don't want to drive anyone away. And so I think I speak for every author on this podcast right now that every single one of us would be delighted and honored to be a part of your Hispanic Heritage Month celebration. And every single one of us will be just as good a speaker come October 16th as we were on October 15th. So please reach out for Hispanic Heritage Month. It's happening soon. Do it now, or do it as soon as you can. If school starts the day after Labor Day and it's 10 days in and you need to set something up really quickly, do it. Please reach out. And if it can't happen during Hispanic Heritage Month because it's just too soon in the school year and you do not have the bandwidth to plan something, I promise you, nothing magical changes on October 16th that makes me not as good at speaking or doing school visits.
You are absolutely right. You're here. Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Exactly what I have on my website. It's good for Hispanic Heritage Month, but it's good for any other day of the year. So, yep, absolutely. Well, ladies, this has been delightful. I think we have come to the end of our soiree or afternoon. So do we have any parting thoughts, anyone? Are we ready to wrap it up? I think we're done. All right. So if you would like to learn more about Las Musas or our books, please visit our website at lasmusasbooks.com or find us on social media at Las Musas Books. And be sure to check out our bookshop page, where each purchase of one of our books goes towards supporting independent bookstores. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast. You can also sign up for Las Musas newsletter to have podcast update, as well as other Musa news, such as release dates, teasers, spotlights, and more, delivered straight to your inbox. Thanks for listening. Y'all take care.